It's extremely special. From the moment I was traded here, I had pressure on myself. I think a lot of other people put pressure on me to help this team get to where we're at now. And I don't shy away from those pressure. I understand why I was brought here. It's very fulfilling when you have that pressure to succeed and you have a good game or multiple good games and you help your team get to the World Series. I mean, there's no better feeling. Now, I've been on the other side of that twice. Before, I went to two World Series where we swept the championship round and the team we were playing went six or seven games, and I felt like we lost a step, you know, with the downtime. It's such a unique sport where, you know, you go all season long with not having many off days at all, and then all of a sudden you find yourself with a week off. It can be different.
I think there's some positive nerves in there, and just because we're playing for a city that's had a lot go on this year, and that's the main reason why. But when you get to this point, there's only two teams left, and you're the best team in the American League. It's a good feeling. A lot of smiles today, a lot of carefree attitudes, and hoping to go into game one and steal one of two, or, you know, play some good ball here.
It meant a lot in Chicago when we were saying we get to go to the World Series. That's a special thing. But now we're flipping the switch a little bit. We're trying to figure out how to win four games. You know, after the season's over, look back on it and hopefully, you know, have a World Series trophy to celebrate. There's always butterflies. I think this time is when the butterflies and the anxious is more so than once you throw that first pitch, it kind of all goes away. And I think leading up to the game is when the anxiety kind of kicks in just because you want to get things going. It's a good feeling. Care about what you're doing more than anything.
To be managing against them now in this situation is really surreal. I think after we advanced, he reached out to me, and then after they advanced, I reached out to him, and then from that point on, it's been a radio silence.
Two games in a row where we just really weren't ready. You know, we got to figure that out, whether it's those five guys changing their mindset or whether we have to change the lineup to get some guys in there who can be ready to go at the beginning of the game. That was disappointing tonight, the start of the game. I mean, the whole thing was disappointing. The start was disappointing in terms of the effort.
First week, like we told y'all, was a long week for him, just trying to adjust to the new system, adjust to what we're trying to do. And I don't think it's just him. I mean, obviously, Z has good names, but I think a lot of guys are trying to adjust as well. Jay as well, D-Rose as well, you know, all the new guys, Jeff Green as well. We're all trying to figure out, you know, how can we help these guys get acclimated as quickly as possible. But this is a marathon, and he knows it, and he's been a part of it. And, you know, there's a lot of sprint for week two. It's going to be much better than week one for all of us.
You know, our goal was to try to and see how it was. But, you know, I just decided earlier than later just to get to the unit where, you know, I'll be more comfortable in and could probably be better with this team in that lineup. Why wait? You know, three games in, you know, why wait? I wanted to get in there, you know, with those guys.
If he comes off the bench, they can use him as their primary scorer. Out of respect to Dwayne Wade and because LeBron was favoring it, Ty Lue put Dwayne in the starting lineup to start the year. Most people who watched figured this wasn't going to last for very long, and it was Dwayne who decided to pull the plug on it. I think the Cavs are going to have quite a few lineup changes as the year goes along, but the fact that Dwayne, for the first time in his career, 15th season, will be a bench player now is pretty significant.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to Yon Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are. Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having a great Tuesday afternoon. My, oh my. Ooh, we got a lot of things to get into today. A very packed montage put together there by Mr. Cushlin. World Series action starts tonight. Justin Verlander will not be a part of it. Only because he was the guy who saved the season, essentially, for the Houston Astros and put them into the World Series. Dallas Keuchel and Clayton Kershaw will go at it tonight. By the way, hey, Cush.
Yeah.
Are you convinced, and not that we'll get into more of the World Series talk coming up at 3:35 with Chris Cotillo of MLB, DailyDish.com, and we'll get into the depth of this, but are you buying the narrative that Clayton Kershaw has now shaken his postseason demons, if you will, exorcise those, you know, because he's been the greatest pitcher maybe in, I don't know, a generation in the regular season. I mean, numbers and dominance in the regular season that go back to, you know, the greatest days of Koufax, the greatest days of Gibson, of Pedro Martinez, of virtually any great dominant pitcher that there's ever been. But then in the postseason, it's never there for him. And in the NLCS, he pitched the clinching, the series clinching, the pennant clinching win with six dominant innings, six shutout innings, I believe, or maybe it was one run innings. I'm trying to remember exactly how that went. And people said, you know, finally Clayton Kershaw gets that massive win that he had to have. Are you buying that, Kush? And there's a reason I'm asking the question. Just go ahead and tell me whether you are or not.
I am not buying it, and right now, in addition to saying I'm not buying it, come back to me with that question after the World Series. If he has a couple of nice World Series starts, and maybe I'll start to change that thought.
I think that's a very good answer. But I'm not ready yet. And the reason I'm not, you know, a lot of people were praising Clayton Kershaw, after he shut down the Cubs and won that pennant for the Dodgers, first time they're in the show since
88 with the famed Kirk Gibson in Game 1. That's the last time the Dodgers were in it.
29 years.
Yep. So,
and the reason why is they won that game 11-1.
Right.
They staked him to, I want to say, like a 7-0 lead. You talk about pitching free and easy. You talk about having all kinds of margin for error. You talk about every aspect of that was about as easy as it gets if you're pitching in the playoffs. And he's not going to show me that he is a postseason dominant starter until he does that six-inning, one-run performance or shutout performance or whatever in a 1-0 game or in a 2-1 game or in a game in which every pitch could change the outcome of the game. Every pitch has something riding on it, because when you do it the way he did it, every pitch had all kinds of margin for error. Hell, you could load him up and give up a salami and still be up by 3 in the third inning. You know, so to me, Clayton Kershaw is one of the great, great regular season pitchers we have seen ever in Major League Baseball. But I'm not ready to say, I mean, even with that performance, you know, his ERA is still almost 3.5 or 3.30 or something like that in the postseason this year. And this is a good postseason for him.
Yeah.
In most postseasons, he gets shelled worse than that. So I don't know what it is about some guys who don't turn up the heat, you know, when they're great in the regular season and they don't turn up the heat in the postseason. And he just seems to be one of those guys that has maybe clearly the physical ability is there, but a mental block, some sort of an internal pressure that maybe he feels that he just doesn't know how to deal with. So I'll tell you what. I'm kind of liking the Houston Astros in this World Series. I don't know if I'm ready to say I would go to Vegas and put my mortgage on it, but if you're asking me if I did have a significant amount of money to bet, and I had to bet under penalty of death, I would bet on the Astros. I feel like the Keuchel and Verlander twosome, and they have more than that, obviously. If LA has to go Kershaw 1-4 or 1-4-7, you know, the way Kluber did a year ago, I'm liking the Astros' chances. I really am.
Yeah, and by the way, speaking of Verlander, you mentioned he won't be a part of tonight. Well, yeah, that also, and he's a tomorrow night's game 2 starter, FYI, against Rich Hill.
Yeah, well, that's about that.
That's because, the other part of it.
Because he started the last game, you know.
Right, and he's on still regular rest, too, with all of that. But, no, when it comes to Kershaw and the way you're saying this right now, it reminds me of past conversations on these airwaves in bygone years that I've had regarding CC Sabathia, where honestly my stance was, no, dude is not a big game pitcher. Well, what about 09? Okay, 09 and a little bit of this year, but other than that, he has always flamed out, you know, in the playoffs. And when you're bringing it up about Kershaw just
until
now, it kind of reminded me of that.
By the way, hold on, stay away from Kershaw and just go back to your point. Until this year.
Now, he had a good 09 when they won the World Series, the Yankees, in 09. He was very solid for them in those playoffs.
I know, but what I'm saying is, and you have to add on to that this year.
Right.
Because CC Sabathia was nails.
He was
as much of a reason why the Indians aren't in the World Series as anybody is. He had a tremendous, tremendous postseason this year, CC Sabathia did, at the age of, I don't know, 38, 39, whatever the heck he is.
36.
36? Okay, he just looks older than that because of his body type. But yeah, I mean, he had a great postseason in 09, like you said, when they won the World Series, and he found it again, you know, 8 years later here in 2017, because he had a big, big, big role in the Yankees beating the Indians and then, you know, nearly coming back to win the series against the Astros. But anyway, continue. Go ahead.
No, and it just kind of reminds me, you know, of that conversation. But just because of 2017 and 09, that doesn't change perception that most of the rest of the time he was not a big game pitcher. Like, I'm looking at CeCe in the postseason. Let's see, that when he was with the Indians. Let's see, in the 07, 540, 1045. 08 with Milwaukee, 1227. These are his ERAs in those series. And it goes a lot like that, except for 09 and this year. And the point is that even with this year, no one's going to claim that over the course of his entire career, he's always been, you know, a big game pitcher. So to circle this back to Kershaw, right now, not buying. But at the end of the World Series, if the numbers show it, I may start to, because sometimes for a guy, it just takes one postseason run to finally get it right in that atmosphere, maybe.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that for some guys, and you're right. But it's got to be a full postseason
yes.
run. And you're right about, you know, let's talk about Mr. Kershaw after this postseason, after this World Series is over, and we'll see exactly what he, you know, what he brought to the table for the duration. So really, really interesting stuff. So we got a baseball chat to have, and we're going to have that conversation with Chris Cotilla coming up from MLB Daily Dish at about 3:35 or so. Then coming up at 4:40, we get back to college football with Mike Jenks, head coach of the struggling, to say that is an understatement, the struggling Bowling Green Falcons. They lost their seventh game with just one win against Northern Illinois on Saturday. They come back into action a week from tonight on October 24th. Hold on a second. October, that's not right.
No, it's a Halloween night tilt a week from today at Kent State.
Oh, it is. So I was right.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I was looking at the Northern Illinois date. I was going to say, wait a minute, 21st, today's the 24th. It is the 31st. So they do have Tuesday the 31st at Kent State. The battle between two very struggling programs just not having good years. So anyway, Mike Jenks will be by coming up at about 4:40 to talk about that college football. I want to ask a question now that has nothing to do with games last night, although I could sit here and riff about Carson Wentz and what a just a monumental mistake that the Browns made again in making that trade with
the Eagles. Let's not do that. I don't feel like giving myself a headache today.
I think anybody who's every time you watch Carson Wentz play, if you're a Browns fan or if you, you know, used to be a Browns fan, which is kind of my case, anybody who ever, you know, watches him is going to think about that and think that could have been ours. That could have been ours. He is arguably, along with Tom Brady, arguably, the front runner for the MVP 7 weeks into the National Football League season. Would we agree with that, Jim? He, along with Tom Brady, and I have to make sure to include Tom Brady because, my God in heaven, the man flat out does not age. It's bizarre.
Yeah,
he has more passing yards than anybody else in football, and it's not close. He has about 250 more yards than the next closest guy, which is Alex Smith. Tom Brady has a quarterback rating of 108.4. That actually trails Alex Smith with his 120. But Brady's 15. Oh my God! Here's why Alex Smith doesn't have any picks. Alex Smith.
Oh, there you go.
If the Chiefs had not lost back-to-back games, we could revisit this.
Yeah.
But they did, and so he's got 15 touchdowns and no picks. Tom Brady's got 15 and draws two picks, and he's leading the league in touchdown or in yards, I should say, total yards passing, yards per game, et cetera, et cetera. But skip down then to Carson Wentz, who's fourth in yards at 1852 and third in quarterback rating behind Smith and Brady with 104, and he's leading the league in touchdown passes. 17 touchdowns, 4 picks, 1,852 yards for arguably the most complete and best team in football. So you just kind of have to mention that. Brady at age 40 looking like he's 25, playing maybe at the highest level he's ever played in his career, doing so without Julian Edelman, doing so with Gronkowski only on a part-time basis because of his constant injuries.
Right.
It is just ridiculous. It doesn't matter what weapons he has around him. It doesn't matter what weapons he loses to injury. It doesn't matter what weapons they give him in replacement. He makes them all look better than they are. It's just a gift that you cannot, you can't replicate. You can't duplicate. There's no other way to say it. Tom Brady at age 40 looks 25, and it's not fair to the rest of the world. But Carson Wentz has got to be right there along with Alex Smith as an MVP candidate. So I don't want to react too strongly to Carson Wentz's 4 touchdown performance last night and the Eagles' status maybe as the best team in football. This came up in a conversation that I overheard, actually, between some other sports fans. And they were talking about how LeBron James is a dedicated, devoted Dallas Cowboys fan. and people I heard talking about pointed out something that's very accurate. If you look at LeBron's age, he's 32 years old, and he grew up in Northeast Ohio, down there in Akron, at a time when really everything was bad as far as his hometown. By that, I mean extending up to Cleveland, sports teams. There was no real reason to get excited about the Cleveland Browns at the time that he was growing up. There was no reason to get excited at all about the Cavaliers at the time he was growing up. There was no real reason, and especially with Michael Jordan being the guy that everybody liked in every city, no matter what's new, you know, where you were, no real reason to get excited for the Cleveland Indians either. So he's a Yankees fan. And somebody brought up the fact that there are people when you grow up, and especially in the football side of things here in this conversation, when you grow up with the worst team in football or one of the worst teams in football as your quote-unquote home team because of where you're born, and they don't give you any reason whatsoever to get excited about watching them play. They don't give you any reason to you know, wear a playoff shirt with pride. We won the division. We're a playoff team. We're this, that, the other. It's very easy for them to just kind of have their eyes and their attention diverted to other things, to other teams that are a little bit more fun, that are a little bit more successful, that are a little bit more enjoyable to watch. And in his case, it was the Dallas Cowboys. And it got me to wondering, and I just kind of wanted to throw this out there. If anybody wants to call and answer this question, I would love to hear it. Is it still mandatory for a young boy, and I'm not saying girls aren't sports fans, but bear with me, this is sports talk. Is it mandatory? Is it a must that a young boy growing up in a given sports city, now Toledo's a little different, of course, because there isn't a professional franchise here. No disrespect, of course, to Walleye or
you know, those are professional, but those are the minor league level. That's a different ballgame.
But it is professional.
Yes.
Which is why I clarified that.
Right.
But the major leagues.
Yes.
If you grow up in a major league city, is it a must that you root for the team that plays in that city simply because of where you were born? Or is it okay to root for somebody that you just like, that you just, they caught your attention? Do we have to stay loyal to the home team simply because of where we were born? If you just don't have an affinity or a feel or a like or a player on that team or a moment in time that just made you go, oh my God, I love that. Is it okay to like, if you grow up in Ann Arbor, do you have to be a Michigan fan? Is it okay if you just, there's something about that Spartan on the side of that helmet that makes you excited, that you like? If you grow up in Columbus, do you have to be a Buckeye fan? Can you grow up surrounded by scarlet and gray, but just really drawn to that winged helmet of that team up north? It's just kind of cool. If you grow up in Cleveland, is it okay, like LeBron James did, to say, I love that star? Dallas Cowboys are America's team. I'm America. It's my team. Can you grow up rooting for the Pittsburgh Steelers if you grow up in Northeast Ohio or maybe even over here in Northwest Ohio? Because, well, the teams that you're surrounded by, the Lions to the north, the Browns to the east, are crap. They haven't given you the Browns last won a playoff game in, what, 1995?
Yeah, January 95 for the 94 season.
So that's 22 years?
Mm-hmm.
And we know the Lions haven't won a playoff game in, what, 27 years?
Yeah, that 91 game.
So if you're surrounded by crap, and you look at somebody else who's doing well, and you go, oh, my God, what a great pal, what a great catch. I like these guys. They're fun for me. Is that a crime? Is that a capital crime in the sports world anymore? I just want to know if anybody, and again, it might be hard here in Toledo because we don't have, you know, a major professional team here. We don't have an MLB, NBA, or NFL team or NHL team here specifically, even though we're geographically close to some. I just want to know. And one of the reasons why when I heard that conversation today, it kind of grabbed me is because my son, who's 14, who's a freshman, is not a Browns fan. He is a Steelers fan, even though he was, technically he was born in Florida. He was born just outside of Orlando, Florida. But he was raised, you know, in our family as a Browns fan in Northeast Ohio. That's where he was born and grew up in his formative years, and he is not a Browns fan. And I'm like, dude, why? Why? And there are two reasons why. Number one is what I said a moment ago, that he was born in 2003. The Browns, since they returned 4 years before that in 1999, have been the biggest laughingstock perhaps in the history of team sports. Nobody has sucked as bad for as long as this team has.
I know, right? Even the Raiders fixed things.
Right, right. I mean, you know, the Browns last won a championship in 1964. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers came into existence in 1977 and have won a Super Bowl since that time.
Mm-hmm.
The Seattle Seahawks came into existence in 1977, same time as the Buccaneers. They came into existence, grew through the pain of expansion team-ness, and developed enough and grew their franchise, and they won a Super Bowl.
And have been to three total, too.
Exactly. Since the time the Browns last won a championship in 64, I mean, teams that didn't exist have existed and then beaten them to the title. Hell, the Browns haven't even been to the Super Bowl. Neither have the Lions. So I said, dude, why? And there are two reasons I can't fault him for. Number one is there is nothing to get him excited about. Hey, you want to go to the Browns game? Want to drive out to First Energy Stadium? Not really. For what? To watch miserable failure and no joy? I mean, sitting in front of the television on a Sunday and turning it on. For what? He stopped watching them a long time ago. The Steelers were exciting. The Steelers were intriguing. Antonio Brown is dynamic. And the Browns haven't had a player like Antonio Brown since, I don't know, Paul Warfield? I mean, it's crazy. And then the second reason is I did tell him, I confessed to him that I grew up as a young boy his age as a Steelers fan because my mother and father were both from Western Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh. So my father raised me like him as a Steelers fan, and I grew up in the 1970s. Pretty damned easy time to be raised a Steeler fan when they were winning Super Bowls. And it was in my school years in the early 1980s that I went to, you know, school with my buddies, and my buddies are Brown, and I became a Browns fan just because I was with my boys, you know, and hey, sure. Yeah, we're living in Cleveland. But I still had the affinity for the Steelers from my father's memory, and I told my son that. And once he heard that, and he found out that it was okay, Grandpa liked the Steelers, and you did as a kid, it was very easy for him to abandon the Browns. So that's just kind of a question. If we can take some calls on it throughout the show today at various times when we don't have interviews, I would love to hear your thoughts. If you grew up here in, you know, Toledo or Northwest Ohio, do you feel like you have to be a Lions fan? Was it forced upon you? Or a Browns fan if your family is, you know, leaning that direction? Do you feel like you have to be either a Michigan or an Ohio State fan? Or can you like USC if you want? Can you like the Hurricanes, like a lot of people do from around? Or can you like Notre Dame? Well, that's a little bit more regional too, but if you understand the point. Do you have to root for the Tigers or the Indians, or can you be a Yankee fan like LeBron James? Are you locked into fandom for the city that you were born and raised in, or is it okay now, especially in this much more globalized sports world that we're in because of the internet and social media? In the 70s, Jim, or in the 80s when you were growing up as a little kid.
Yeah.
Your highlights consisted of whatever you got on the three network news channels during the 2.5 minutes they gave the sports guy at
right.
the end of the 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock newscast. And all you got were the Indians highlights, all you got were the Browns highlights, all you got were the Cavaliers highlights. Then you got the sports page the next day. That's it. It was very easy to be regionalized and marginalized as a limited geographical fan because this is where you are and this is all you know. But in the global community we have today, thanks to the internet and thanks to social media, you can lock in and have personalized settings on your smartphone to just bring me Yankees news and Yankees highlights. And it's like living in the Bronx. You can do the same thing for a team in California, a team in Pennsylvania, a team in Texas. It doesn't matter. You don't necessarily, none of us are as regional as we used to be. None of us are as locked into the geography of the place of our birth as we used to be. Because we have access to everything and everywhere, is it okay then to be attracted, as the case may be, to some of those other teams from other places, other locations, because I kind of think that the world has changed in sports in that regard. So if you've got thoughts on it, we'll hear it. 866-240-1065. But for now, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
Well, Wild Wings, Wild Stat of the Day, this season may be still very young in the NFL, but a Wild Stat comes from, or in the NBA, beg your pardon, but the Wild Stat does come out of the Pistons' land. Andre Drummond apparently can shoot free throws. Drummond, as we know, is a career 38% free throw shooter. I could shoot that with my foot. But so far this young season, he's 10 for 12 at the line, which is 83%. Are you serious? Last season, Drummond was right at that career average of 38% from the line, but his previous career high for a season is 42%. But thus far, in a very young season, 83% for Andre Drummond. Miracles can happen. How about that? All right, let's get a quick timeout for a bottom of the hour Sports Center. Then we'll come back and we'll talk a little baseball, World Series style. Chris Cotilla from MLB Daily Dish, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It meant a lot in Chicago when we were saying we get to go to the World Series. That's a special thing. But now we're flipping the switch a little bit. We're trying to figure out how to win four games. You know, after the season's over, look back on it and hopefully, you know, have a World Series trophy to celebrate. There's always...
What an amazing month and a half or so it's been for Justin Verlander, huh? From the doldrums, from the bot... I'm sorry, what?
That was Kershaw I played.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not.
Still though,
I'm
what
not,
you're saying
I'm not
about
reacting
her.
To the audio.
Okay.
I'm reacting to the World Series, or I'm actually previewing what I want to talk about with our guest Chris Cotilla for the World Series. Justin Verlander. In the last 6 weeks, he went from, or maybe close to 8 weeks, I suppose, the doldrums of the woebegone Detroit Tigers, who decided to sell off all of their parts except for him at one point in time, and Miguel Cabrera. But they're selling off people that were instrumental in what was supposed to be a playoff contending season. It's a lost season. The Indians are rolling. The Tigers are just lost in Nowheresville. And at the very last moment before the waiver deadline, he does get moved to a team that ends up in the World Series, thanks in large part to yesterday's Wild Stat of the Day. Kush, refresh my memory, but I think I have it. In nine starts, 8-0.
9-0
with an ERA of 1.22.
Yep.
And oh, by the way, if you need it, here's the American League Championship Chip Series MVP, Justin Verlander. He'll go tomorrow night in game number two. It's Dallas Keuchel tonight. He will face the guy that you just heard in Clayton Kershaw tonight in game one of the World Series. And here to talk about all things baseball is Chris Cotilla, MLBDailyDish.com. Hey, Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Not as good as Justin Verlander. I mean, you know, we've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks, really, you know, in the postseason. As well as he has pitched for the Astros, the way he pitched down the stretch for the Houston Astros after that trade, and it's like he must have felt like he was just given the fountain of youth. And that's not to say that he was pitching like an old man for Detroit. He wasn't, but the inspiration and the motivation and everything else that comes along with it, just kind of restoking the competitive fires in what has been one of baseball's best pitchers of his era. He has just been flat-out dominant, and he is the reason, no disrespecting to Dallas Keuchel or to Carlos Correa or Jose Altuve or any of the other, you know, in very integral parts of what the Astros are, but he has been the main reason they are in the World Series facing those Dodgers starting tonight. Agree?
Yeah, I think he's one of them. Obviously, Altuve's done really well in the playoffs, and a lot of different heroes have stepped up. Keuchel's been fantastic, but Verlander has not just met expectations from what they could have expected when they acquired him in August, but really exceeded them. You know, I think you were talking about, if you're the Astros, really wanting that one more starter to pair with what looked like Keuchel and McCullers at the time. Obviously, McCullers has struggled a little bit, not the other night, but struggled a little bit down the stretch and with some injuries, and you add, you know, that 1-2 punch from Verlander and Keuchel is really devastating in the postseason. Now, obviously, you have a guy in Verlander for two more years after this, so the value is not just for now, but he's already, if obviously they win a World Series with him now and he's a key part of that, he will already be worth it and already worth the trade that they made and having to give up a lot at the end of August. So it really has kind of, you know, that competitive fire is back for him. I think it is Really interesting to think back that he had a tough decision, and it came down to 2 seconds before the deadline. When he decided to go to Houston, he could have stayed in Detroit and been golfing by now or hanging out with Kate Upton and stuff like that. So I think it's a good choice for his career, and obviously he's been phenomenal.
To make my point a little more clear, everything you just said, by the way, 100% accurate, 100% right. There are a lot of reasons why the Astros are where they are, but let me make my point a little bit more clear with this question. If he says no, are the Astros still in the World Series? If he had in that last second said, I'm going to stay, I'm going to go golfing, I'm going to go hang with Kate, I'm not going to Houston, I'm going to veto that trade, are the Astros in the World Series without him?
I think they had potential, but you're talking about your number two being, you know, the guys who are a little bit lesser guys, whether that's McCullers or Morton or Brad Peacock or some of the guys that are not Verlander. You know, I think it's obviously a lot tougher to get by the Red Sox in that series and much tougher to get by the Yankees in the ALCS. You know, I think the Indians getting eliminated kind of regardless of what the Astros were doing kind of makes me think that they would have had a chance, but Verlander really sealed the fate as they were the best team in the American League. And they have been throughout the postseason. I think a lot of people are really high on Cleveland, especially after that long win streak. But, I think they might have gotten here without Verlander, but it would have been a lot harder.
No question about that. Chris Cotilla joining us from MLBDailyDish.com talking about the World Series. I want to go to the ace on the other side, the man you did hear in that clip on the way in, which was Clayton Kershaw. Some say that his performance in the NL pennant-winning game over the Cubs kind of cast out his postseason demons. We all know he's been one of the most, if not the most dominant starting pitcher in the regular season that we have seen in recent memory. Certainly, you know, his numbers over the course of the last 5, 6, 7 seasons are up there with any stretch that great Hall of Famers like Sandy Koufax ever had, just to pick a Dodger. But in the postseason, we know that it has been a different story. Do you agree that his resume is now clear, or clear isn't my word, that his record is now clear and that his resume is not going to say postseason flop because of that performance in which he went 6 innings of dominant baseball in that pennant-clinching win over the Cubs? Or do you take that with a little bit of grain of salt like I do, because you talk about pitching with a comfort zone and an early, 6 or 7 run lead over the Cubs in a game they would eventually win 11-1? I'm still not convinced that he can handle the postseason pressure.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of concern. You know, his postseason ERA all time is still, you know, higher than 4 this year. We even saw him struggle, even a little bit against Arizona, a game they won there in game 1, but still, a game that he didn't pitch his best. And I think he did pitch well in the NLCS, and he stepped up on a stage where, you know, he's kind of failed to do so before, especially last year playing against the Cubs. At Wrigley, kind of exercise those demons. I think, you know, tonight really goes a lot into his postseason legacy. I think, for a lot of people, postseason performance and winning a World Series, being a champion and performing on the biggest stage is a big part of a legacy, a big part of a Hall of Fame candidacy. I think Clayton Kershaw is a Hall of Famer already, no matter what, so I don't think that really matters. But I think, you know, it would elevate him to that level of October hero. You know, something that's interesting to me is a lot of times we compare Bumgarner and Kershaw just because they're on rivals. They're both lefties. Yeah. Kershaw, obviously, the better regular season career, and Bumgarner, way better in the postseason, really put the Giants on his back in 2014 and was able to win a World Series basically by himself. So I think, you know, it's a big step for him to really get his first World Series start tonight and really set the tone of this series. If he pitches well against a great lineup, I think we can say that monkey is off his back a little bit. But, you know, it has been not just a couple bad starts. He's pitched in 6 or 7 postseasons now, and this is the first time they've gotten to the World Series. When you have the best pitcher in the world, that's a little bit tough to see. But, you know, as they say, winning cures all. So I think if he's able to come out tonight and put a strong performance in tonight and then, you know, potentially pitch in a clinching game later in the series if the Dodgers are up, then everything will be fine, and we'll look at his legacy a lot differently.
What are you predicting on that, Chris? Do you think he has a strong start tonight, or do you think the moment gets to him?
Yeah, no, I think they both will have a strong start. You know, I think we see, you know, more times than not these guys in game 1 come out and they are, you know, dominant. The pressure of the World Series for, you know, these guys, for the most part, none of them have been in it. These are two teams that, you know, have not been in the World. The Dodgers obviously haven't been since 88. The Astros, no one on the current roster was there in 05. So you're talking about a lot of guys that are new to this environment. And I think nerves really kick in for everybody, but especially the hitters under those bright lights, you know, especially on a night like tonight. So for me, I think you know, I do think both Kershaw and Keuchel will pitch well. It'll be a pitcher's duel right down to the end. And I would take the Dodgers in game one just because, again, at the end of the day, you have the best pitcher in the world, as good as Keuchel is. I'd take the Astros in game two just because I think Verlander's that much better than Hill. So I expect a split heading back to Houston. But tonight, there's no one really in the world you'd rather have than Clayton Kershaw, postseason demons or not.
We're talking to Chris Cotilla, MLBDailyDish.com, about the World Series. We're also going to talk about some baseball news outside of the World Series as manager changes have been made, obviously. Detroit has a new manager. The Indians lost a pitching coach who becomes a new manager. But I'll get to that after Jim Cushlin asks you a question. Jim, go ahead.
And the other thing, obviously, guys, other than the pitchers that at least caught my attention, raised my eyebrow a bit, is for the Dodgers, Corey Seager. He's back on the roster. He wasn't part of the NLCS roster. He's been dealing with that back. What's his status? Is he going to be fully ready to go? Because deep down, I still believe the Dodgers need this guy.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, him and Bellinger are really the keys for them. We've seen some kind of unsung hero step up. I don't think we can call Justin Turner an unsung hero anymore, but Chris Taylor and obviously Kike Hernandez, Puig is a big name who's been disappointing at times. So we've seen these guys step up and be great. And obviously, you know, you're looking at, you know, Seager back in the lineup tonight. I think he's batting sixth. So that is a big piece for them. That is a big, big piece for them. And if he's healthy, I think it just increases their chances of winning. They're already the favorite in my mind and the favorite in Vegas' mind. So having Seager back is a huge help.
Chris Cotilla joining us, MLBDailyDish.com, talking about the World Series. But let me get away from that for just a moment to talk about the manager carousel tracker, as you have on the website right now. And I want to start with your thoughts on longtime Twins manager, highly successful Twins manager Ron Gardenhire, now taking over a rebuilding project, to say the very least, in Detroit. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I like the hire. I think it's a very safe one. You know, last time they went out and did this, once Leland was gone, they decided really to go out and get kind of a hot managerial candidate, the hot young managerial candidate, and Brad Ausmus, who a lot of people were talking about. I think he was that offseason's version of Alex Cora is now. And now they kind of went with the guy who's proven himself, who's been a major league manager, obviously not in the last couple of years, but knows how to win in the AL Central. Has a big track record. So I think, you know, I will say, I think Cora was the top choice of almost every team this year just for a variety of factors. But, you know, as a rebuilding team, you have less choices than the other teams in the market. I think the Tigers, you know, obviously aren't as attractive as a spot as the Red Sox or, say, the Nationals for a manager. So once it became clear that Cora was probably going to the Red Sox, I think Gardenhire really established himself as one of the better candidates out there and got the job, an experienced guy and a safe play. I like the move for Detroit.
All right, so let's go to Cora now, because you're talking about the experienced older manager like Gardenhire being the right guy for Detroit, and a very different call than when they made the call on the hot, young, rising guy like Brad Ausmus. You compared Ausmus to Cora in that regard. It didn't end well for for Ausmus, obviously. You have a little more faith that Cora is going to be the right guy for your Red Sox.
Yeah, I do. You know, I think the Red Sox are at a spot where they're going to be World Series contenders next year. You know, some moves are going to have to be made. They're probably going to have to add a power bat. You know, I think they still miss David Ortiz even a year after he retired. I think everyone in Boston does. So it's tough to replace. But it was time for John Farrell to move. And I think, you know, Alex Cora was the guy they identified probably in the middle of the season as the replacement. I really thought Jason Varitek would get a look. But they really only interviewed three candidates, Ausmus, Gardenhire, and who we've been talking about. And then Alex Cora, and Cora was the clear favorite. That's clear. They already named him the manager, even though he's still working for the Astros. And I think, you know, 42 years old, has a variety of roles, a media member, a bench coach, a GM of Puerto Rican leagues, obviously a respected veteran who played in Boston, won a World Series in Boston, a guy who's bilingual. I think that really has a huge impact. So I think people in Boston are really happy with that move. Any team would have been happy with Alex Cora as their manager, and the Red Sox are in the position where they have this attractive spot. So I like the move for them, and I like the move Gardenhire as well. We'll see what shakes out with the Phillies and Nationals, but so far I think the teams are getting really kind of what has been expected.
I want to ask you about Mickey Callaway's departure from Cleveland. I don't really care much about his arrival in the Mets because I don't like the Mets. I don't care about the Mets. I do like the Indians, and I do like the job he has done turning the Indians rotation into the best rotation in the American League, if not the best rotation in baseball. I think they had the best bullpen in the American League, at least right up there neck and neck with the Yankees in that regard as well. I don't know how much of that has to do with Mickey Callaway or not, but the Mets obviously think it had a lot to do with it because he's their new manager. How badly will the Indians miss a guy like that?
Well, I think, you know, the Mets really identified, you know, just a guy that they wanted, a pitching guy, just because that team lives and dies on young pitching, whether it be Syndergaard, DeGrom, Wheeler, Matz, Harvey, all those guys. So I think that was a great fit, but the Indians are going to miss him. You know, he's been highly regarded as one of the best pitching coaches in baseball. I will say that if you're going to lose a pitching coach, right now is the time. There are a ton of candidates out there, whether it be Jim Hickey, Dave Island, some of these other guys we've seen. You know, there's a pitching coach carousel this year is a lot different and a lot stronger than the managerial candidate carousel. I think you've had the Cubs, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, the Red Sox might be in the running. So you have a lot of guys that are really out there and available. So the Indians have a lot of good choices. I think those interviews are all going to get underway. There's a lot of teams looking, but you know, you want to go to that Indian staff if you're a pitching coach. And I, after the work Mickey Callaway's put in, as well, along with just the broad talent on that roster, there's no pitching coach that wouldn't want to work with that staff. So I think just because of the available options, the gulf won't be that wide, but still, just to show, you never see pitching coaches become managers. It's very rare, and, you know, the big one that comes to mind is John Farrell, Bud Black being another, but it's when they do, it shows you how respected those guys are, and I think the Mets made a good move there, too.
Yeah, if I could jump in on this, because I'm glad you mentioned specifically, Chris, a second ago, John Farrell, because I read somebody, I think it was on ESPN, but I can't remember, the other day, yesterday, because this happened formally yesterday, that maybe the Indians should look into John Farrell, now ousted as Boston's manager. He worked at times, of course, with Frank Kona in Boston. Is that an avenue that's in any way possible, and should the Indians pursue something like that?
You know, I think it's definitely possible. And I hadn't heard it, but as soon as you mentioned it, the wheel started turning my head about it. I think obviously Francona and Farrell have worked together. Farrell has a long history with the Indians, and that's clear. And I think it's definitely possible. Another name that I've heard specifically linked to that, Kurt Young, who's been with the Athletics, been with the Red Sox, some other clubs, if he could, you know, step in. There's a lot of options. So I think, you know, obviously Farrell is available. He probably, his first choice is getting a managerial job, I'm sure. He might get a look from the Nationals, maybe the Phillies, but it does sound a possibility to me that they'll at least explore it just based on the familiarity there with Farrell and Francona and Farrell and the Indians.
Chris, I want to ask you one more manager question, because it's one of the more controversial decisions, and that was the decision by the Nats to fire Dusty Baker. 2 years, two division championships, 191 wins, I think what the number was in the 2 years, and sent packing. Some say it's completely not fair. What are you supposed to do? You take your team to the playoffs every year. Obviously, he knows how to do that. But then you look at his track record in the postseason, and I don't have it in front of me, but I retweeted it a few hours after they fired him. NLDS. First round, lost in the wild card game. It's either first round exits or wild card exits in his last five trips to the playoffs as a manager of somebody. So how do you evaluate that? I mean, a guy's job is to win in the regular season and get there. And then in the postseason, they're not getting there. Some are saying it's an unfair firing. Some are saying, hey, you know, you need somebody who's going to take you over the top once they get there. How do you view the Dusty firing?
I just think it's tough to identify who's going to be better out on the market. You know, I think Alex Cora is the guy that they would have wanted, just like everybody. Like I mentioned, he's obviously in Boston. So, you know, you're seeing, since the Nationals have been there, and just guys having a pretty short leash, whether it be, you know, Manny Acquia back when, or Davey Johnson was there, won a manager of the year and fired. Matt Williams won manager of the year and was fired. Dusty Baker is a guy who's gotten them to two, obviously gotten them to the playoffs, and all of a sudden, you know, he's gone. I think there's just a lot of dysfunction in that organization, and there's a weird obsession with ownership and the managerial position in Washington that I don't think a lot of people understand. The reason Dusty Baker was the manager in the first place is because they were lowballing Bud Black, who was their number one choice on the offer. Dusty, happier than ever to accept that job, but he was their second choice 2 years ago, and I think people do forget that. As a second choice, he kind of outperformed expectations, you'd think, if you take him, you know, win this many games, get to the playoffs. So it's really tough to see, you know, a guy like Dusty Baker kind of be cursed in the postseason, because by all accounts, he's a great guy and a great regular season manager, and really a good manager who's been with a lot of different clubs and had a lot of success in different places. So for me, you know, it's a callous move, and it's a tough one, but that window on Bryce Harper and Daniel Murphy's closing, the question obviously does become, who could they possibly get to replace? And the options out there are, you know, Dave Martinez, Kevin Long, the non-sexy names that we've been hearing for linked to these other jobs. So, you know, it'll be tough to replace, but I think it's, It's a move that they felt had to be made. I think the timing was weird and kind of disrespectful to a guy like Dusty, but that's business with their managers.
Chris Cotella, that's why we bring him on. He's always got the latest information, good analysis, and insight as always. Chris, thanks so much for the time on the World Series and on the baseball managerial carousel. We always appreciate checking in with you, and we look forward to doing it again after the series.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Chris Cotella, MLBDailyDish.com. Make sure you follow him there. Also, make sure you get to Car Stereo 1 to get yourself ready for the cold weather this year. How? Well, by avoiding the cold weather, of course. Instead of standing outside in it, scraping your windows while you wait for your car to warm up, get yourself a remote car starter from Car Stereo 1. Get the engine started long before you leave the house. You get the car nice and warm and toasty when it's time to hit the road. Steve and his staff at Car Stereo 1 will get you set up with a remote car starter that operates through your own smartphone for just $195 installed. That's right. It's amazing. Now, if you want to wait later this winter, you can pay $300 for the same thing, or you can save the money and do it right now. Your remote car starter awaits, operated by your own smartphone for just $195 installed. Now at Car Stereo 1 on Central, just a block east of C. Coordinate directions, go to carstereo1.com. Turtle, now listen, coming up, we're going to talk about fandom. I talked about it before we talked to Chris Cotella. I want to know, if you are born and raised in Detroit, must you be a Detroit fan? If you're born and raised in Cleveland, must you be an Indians, Browns, and Cavaliers fan? If you're born and raised in the middle, somewhere like in Northwest Ohio, do you have to choose one of the regional teams? Or are you allowed now in the global marketplace that is the modern sports world, thanks to the internet and social media, to root for whoever the hell you like? I want to know if it's still taboo to root against the home team. That part coming up with your calls at 866-240-1065, right here on the Ticket.
It's extremely special. From the moment I was traded here, I had pressure on myself. I think a lot of other people put pressure on me to help this team get to where we're at now. And I don't shy away from those pressure. I understand why I was brought here. It's very fulfilling when you have that pressure to succeed and you have a good game or multiple good games and you help your team get to the World Series. I mean, there's no better feeling. You know, I've been on the other side of that twice. Before, I went to two World Series where we swept the championship round and the team we were playing went six or seven games, and I felt like we lost a step, you know, with the downtime. It's such a unique sport where, you know, you go all season long with not having many off days at all, and then all of a sudden you find yourself with a week off. It can be different.
I think there's some positive nerves in there, and just because we're playing for a city that's had a lot go on this year, and that's the main reason why. But when you get to this point, there's only two teams left, and you're the best team in the American League. It's a good feeling. A lot of smiles today, a lot of carefree attitudes, and hoping to go into game one and steal one or two, or, you know, play some good ball here.
It meant a lot in Chicago when we were saying we get to go to the World Series. That's a special thing. But now we're flipping the switch a little bit. We're trying to figure out how to win four games. You know, after the season's over, look back on it and hopefully, you know, have a World Series trophy to celebrate. There's always butterflies. I think this time is when the butterflies and the anxious is more so than once you throw that first pitch, it kind of all goes away. And I think leading up to the game is when the anxiety kind of kicks in just because you want to get things going. It's a good feeling. Care about what you're doing more than anything.
To be managing against them now in this situation, it's really surreal. I think after we advanced, he reached out to me, and then after they advanced, I reached out to him, and then from that point on, it's been a radio silence.
Two games in a row where we just really weren't ready. You know, we got to figure that out, whether it's those five guys changing their mindset or whether we have to change the lineup to get some guys in there who can be ready to go at the beginning of the game. That was disappointing tonight, the start of the game. I mean, the whole thing was disappointing. The start was disappointing in terms of the effort.
First week, like he told y'all, was a long week for him, just trying to adjust to the new system, adjust to what we're trying to do. And I don't think it's just him. I mean, obviously he has the name, but I think a lot of guys are trying to adjust as well. Jay as well, D-Rose as well, you know, all the new guys, Jeff Green as well. We're all trying to figure out, you know, how can we help these guys get acclimated as quickly as possible. And but this is a marathon, and he knows it, and he's been a part of it. And, you know, it's not a sprint. Week two, it's going to be much better than week one for all of us.
So, you know, our goal was to try to and see how it was. But, you know, I just decided earlier than later just to get to the unit where, you know, I'll be more comfortable in and could probably be better with this team in the lineup. Why wait? You know, three games in, you know, why wait? I wanted to get in there, you know, with those guys.
If he comes off the bench, they can use him as their primary scorer. Out of respect to Dwayne Wade and because LeBron was favoring it, Ty Lue put Dwayne in the starting lineup to start the year. Most people who watched figured this wasn't going to last for very long, and it was Dwayne who decided to pull the plug on it. I think the Cavs are going to have quite a few lineup changes as the year goes along. long, but the fact that Dwayne, for the first time in his career, 15th season, will be a bench player now is pretty significant.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know what, just to touch on that very last topic for a second. Okay, I'll agree that Dwayne Wade coming off the bench for the first time in his career is significant, but it's not as significant as Dwayne tried to make it out to be. He tried to pull the, for the good of the team, I think we'll be better if, blah, 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 when the fact of the matter is he knew Tyronn Lue was going to bench him for J.R. Smith anyway and make him the guy coming off the bench, let J.R. Smith stretch the defense the way that he always has since he's been a Cavalier for LeBron James and the others to do their thing. So I really think this was coming, and Dwayne Wade knew it, and rather than saying he got benched for J.R. Smith, he said, I'll salve the wound ahead of time. I'll pave the way. I'll go ahead and be the bigger man and say, for the good of the team, I will go to the bench. I think it'll be better for everybody, and it makes it look like he's the selfless, sacrificial lamb here, and I just don't buy it, not for a second. But that's all I'm going to say about that. That's no Forrest Gump intended there, but I am not going to say anything more about that. I am going to tell you that we're going to talk about college football coming up with Mike Jinks of Bowling Green at about 4:40, so about 25 minutes from now. Speaking of college football, while we're on that subject, I want to remind you about the Border Battle Contest that ESPN 106.5 The Ticket in Yingling have for you to attend the Michigan-Ohio State game north of the border this time around. That's right. It is November 25th in Ann Arbor with limo service. If you are the winner of this contest from Total Image Limousine, the runner-up in this contest gets a trip for two to the Big Ten Championship game December 2nd at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. You want to qualify for this contest? Register now at 106.5theticket.com or text Border Battle to the number 64636. That's Border Battle to 64636. Those who qualify go to our giveaway party on Thursday night, November 16th at the Blarney Downtown. It's all from Yingling, True House of Munch, Get-Go Transportation, Churchill's, Country Hearth, Tass Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your friends here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. What does it take Jim Cushlin to be a fan? I laid this out in the first half hour, and I want to go to some phone calls now at 866-240-1065. Must you root for the team in which you were born or raised or both because of hometown loyalty? Or are you allowed now, in a much more wide-open world, because of the Internet, because of sports apps, because of instant highlights from any game in any season, any place, anywhere around the country, you can be a fan of pretty much anybody you want now. Is it still a diehard rule that you must root for the team in which city in which you live? Kush?
I'm not sure it was necessarily ever a true diehard rule so much as one of the ways you described it last hour when you first touched on this, Bob, was, you know, back before the social media, internet, and quite frankly, 24-hour sports channels on TV and radio. Yeah, all you had was your local sports page and, you know, your local sports segment where they'd give 2-3 minutes or whatever in the 11 o'clock news. So to me, way back then, I think it was more of a combination of where you lived and your father. I really think that latter part is a huge one. I know for me, it's both. Like, take the Browns thing, for example. I'm not going to stop being a Browns fan, or rephrase, I'm not going to transfer my loyalty to anyone else, essentially, because I'm kind of ingrained on that, and it was a combination of I grew up in that area, and my father and my family were fans of those teams growing up in the same kind of way and passing it along.
And it would have violated the rule had you broken away from that.
Sure.
So there is a rule. You said at the beginning you don't think it was a rule, and I'm going to disagree with you. There is a rule. There's a hard and fast rule that has been adhered to by fans. I mean, kids have been bullied for wearing the wrong jersey to school. If you grew up in Cleveland and you wore a Steelers jersey to school because for whatever reason, you're going to get your tail kicked a little bit.
I do remember some of those stories from the 80s, by the by. I do remember some of those.
That's legitimate. I mean, that kind of thing happens. If you wear a Yankees, you know, hat to an Indians game, LeBron James, you're going to hear it. The rule is, you know what? You're from Northeast Ohio, LeBron James. You're from Akron. You're a half an hour from Progressive, formerly Jacobs Field. You grew up with Municipal Stadium. What is this Yankee crap? You're one of us was the mentality there.
Especially
when they came down on him, because it's a rule. It wasn't a You know, it wasn't a choice. It was a rule.
And especially for the Yankee thing tied to LeBron specifically, you know, you ran through it in most of his upbringing. The only technical mistake you made is actually for a good chunk of him growing up, 94 on, the Indians were actually very good, as we know. They just didn't win a World Series.
That's true.
The Browns didn't exist,
and
the Cavs
were
kind of
garbage. But, Jim, when he was growing up in the 1980s as a kid, they were terrible.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, I mean, actually, hold on. Let me do the math. When was he born?
I want to say 84.
He's 32 now, so he was born in 84?
Well, yeah, he'll be 33 this year, I think. So
they started being really good right around 94 when Progressive Field, then Jacobs Field, was built. So he was 10. So he grew up in his kid years.
Okay, I see
what
you're saying.
Terrible.
All right.
So I think that's one of those things that gives at least a little bit of leeway to somebody to be a fan of a team from another city if you have nothing to root for in your own city. Let me read this real quick, and then I'll go to the phone calls. This is from an old column from Bill Simmons back when he was still with ESPN.com. It's from, I want to say, I don't know, 3 years ago, something like that. Anyway, loyalties. If you live in a city that has fielded a professional team since your formative years, you have to root for that team. None of this, the Bengals weren't very good when I was growing up in Cincy, so I became a Cowboys fan crap. These are the rules of being a sports fan, according to Bill Simmons, and I think he speaks for millions of other fans in this piece. Also, you can't start rooting for a team, back off when they're in the down cycle, then renew the relationship once the team starts winning again. All those Cowboy fans who jumped off the bandwagon in the late 80s, jumped back on during the Emmitt and Aikman era, then jumped back off in the late 90s, you know who you are. You shouldn't even be allowed out in public. There's nothing worse than a bandwagon jumper. If sports were a prison and sports fans made up the prisoners, the bandwagon jumpers would be like the child molesters. Everyone else would pick on them, take turns beating them, and force them. I won't say the rest of that. It's not appropriate. Once you choose a team, you're stuck with that team for the rest of your life unless one of the following conditions applies. Your team moves to another city, in which case, Kush, you and I and anybody else could have just said, that's it. They're gone. Whatever comes back doesn't count.
Yeah. No, I could definitely attest to that. I was living, we had moved to the Washington, D.C. area, my family, right after the Browns moved. We jokingly, and I emphasize the joking part, becoming quote unquote Redskins fans. And let's sum up those couple years for me was when Gus Frat injured himself, ramming his head into the back wall on the touchdown. That summed up the Redskins for me. I couldn't take it. I always said that I laughed at them.
That's and with good reason as well. Once you choose a team, you're stuck with that team for the rest of your life unless you grew up in a city that didn't have a team in a particular sport, so you picked a random team, and then either A, your city did get a team, or you moved to a city that fielded a team for that sport. You are still allowed to stay with the one that you originally decided was your favorite team. You are also stuck with that team once your immediate family members either play professionally or take a relevant management or coaching or front office position with that team. Then you can change your favorite team. And then they get into several others. But bottom line is, there is a geographical requirement, according to a lot of people. There always has been, anyway. That's kind of the point Bill Simmons was making in this. I am submitting to you that there are a few other exceptions to that. As I said, family or familial ties to a different region of the country, even if you weren't born in your formative years or raised in that town, if your parents, particularly your father, was in that different town and raised you as a fan of where he's from, you have a pass. You have a pass. That would define me as a kid because my father and my mother were both from the Pittsburgh area, and my father raised me as a Steelers fan in the 1970s. And like I said, in the late 70s into the early 80s, as I started to go into school and all of my friends were Browns fans and I wanted to be one of my buddies, that's when I said, yeah, me too, and became a Browns fan.
Yeah.
But I never had the hatred for the Steelers that so many, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Browns fans always have had. So that's why I don't bash them as much as I bash other teams that I hate, like the Yankees or the Cowboys or the Ravens or the Patriots or whatever the case might be.
And I guess that's all I was trying to input into that is, to me, the secondary thing right below, you know, where you live / where you're born into is essentially who your father rooted for. And your story demonstrates kind of what I'm trying to say in that.
Exactly. And so I wanted to clarify that. But then the other part of it, like I said, is the fact that I can go onto any one of probably two dozen websites right now and read every newspaper column about, I don't know, pick a team, the Los Angeles Chargers or the, hell, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. You see, my point is that I can act like I'm in that city now. I don't just have my local newspaper. I have the newspaper of every city, of every team, in every sport. I can go to websites and read their articles. I can go to websites and watch their highlights. I can be a part of their fan base by being on their forums, by social media. I can join Facebook pages, the Baltimore Ravens fan page. I can join the Houston Texans fan page and talk with other Texans fans and be like I'm one of them. We're not limited geographically, regionally, the way we used to be by the simple constraints of limited old school media. And I think that's a big, big part of this. And that's why I don't have as much of a problem. If you're a fan in Northwest Ohio or Southeast Michigan and you don't like the Tigers, okay, you like the Cubs, Reds, Dodgers, whatever, I'm kind of not going to rip you for that the way that you would have been ripped 20 years ago before the proliferation of the internet,
right.
40 years ago when I was a child. Nobody, I think, should be forced to root for a team that they don't feel a genuine, true affinity for, have a genuine liking of simply because of the location of their birth. I just don't think that's the case anymore. Carl is in Toledo. He's up first. Let's see what he thinks about this. Hey, Carl, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, Bob?
It's going well. Now, who do you root for first and foremost in the four major sports?
Now, I'm a Steelers fan.
Okay, so what about baseball and basketball and hockey?
Actually, it's kind of weird. Hockey, I've been a Carolina Hurricanes fan. It's weird, but I grew up a little bit in South Carolina. My dad was in the military, so I just kind of rooted for them.
Okay.
They were there.
Nothing wrong with that.
And, you know, basketball, I'm all kind of mixed. It's crazy. I'm a Cavs fan. but I don't really like them so much now that LeBron came back. I kind of liked them when LeBron wasn't there after he left. I kind of rooted for the underdog, you know. They suck,
I
and
that,
I liked them out.
I did, too. I like that. So you're a Pittsburgh football, Carolina hockey, Cleveland basketball.
Yeah.
So you're all over the place. Where are you from? Where were you born?
Right. Actually, I was born in Germany, but I grew up in Toledo. I grew up here in Toledo.
Okay, so you're from Northwest Ohio, essentially. Your formative years were in Northwest Ohio, and you became this. How'd you become all that?
Honestly, there are so many Steelers fans in Northwest Ohio. I mean, they're more. I believe there are more Steelers fans in Northwest Ohio than there are Lions fans, to be honest. Bars, you go to bars, there's just Steelers jerseys everywhere. You know, I think maybe Roethlisberger being from 45 minutes away, Nate Washington growing up here, I think that all has something to do with it. I don't know. Browns, there's a lot of Browns fans. You got to give those guys credit. But I'll tell you what, you don't know you're a loyal fan until you're watching highlights of your team and they're doing a montage before the game of your team and you get goosebumps on your arms. That's how you know that's your team, man. And you just can't feel that way about another team, man. You get them goosebumps when you watch the old montage they're showing Sunday Night Football or whatever it is, you know, and it's just a crazy feeling. And that's why it's just like, you know, football or any sport all around, just with, you know, NFL Network and all that, and everything's just so out there open. It's just easier to be a fan of anybody you want.
Now, do you take any grief from your fellow kids when you were growing up in Northwest Ohio and Toledo? Did you take any grief for not wearing Honolulu Blue or not wearing the Browns or whatever it is that your friends did?
Honestly, not really. There were Browns fans, but I'm 27, so, you know, we kind of had a lot of there were a lot of Steelers games on TV, you know, in the early 2000s when I was a teenager. So, you know, NFL ticket was a thing.
Yeah, there were a lot of them on TV, but you did, you know what I mean? But, and I don't know how many Steelers fans. You said there's a lot of them in Toledo, a lot of them in
this area. I can attest that there are, actually.
And I know that, but I still have to believe there are more, right? More Lions fans in Toledo, Ohio, more Browns fans in Toledo, Ohio
Browns, probably, yes. But Lions, no, not so much. I can count on my hand how many Lions fans I know.
Really?
Like, personally, and working even today, and just Facebook friends and all that. Yeah, there are not many Lions fans.
Well, what about
right
Tigers?
Here, but,
because my assumption would be, because of the Hens and the affiliation with the Tigers, is that people who root for the Tigers would then extend that to the Pistons, into the Wings, into the Lions.
Yeah. For some reason, I think it skips the lines. I mean, the Wings, for sure. I mean, there are Wings fans everywhere. I mean, that Wings are, but that's all over the country, too, though, to be honest. When I was in Carolina, going to Carolina games, and the Wings would come and play there, I mean, the place would be packed with Wings fans, you know, in North Carolina.
I believe every bit of that. I don't have any doubt about that. But the Lions thing kind of surprises me, I suppose. Well, I mean, maybe not, but like I said, because there are people who are in Cleveland, Ohio, Jim, you know this, downtown Cleveland, Ohio, who have just decided they've sworn off the Browns. The fatigue has gotten to them. They have been worn down to the point where the misery no longer makes the joy worthwhile, if that makes any sense. The misery is so deep and dark that even the joy can't lift you out of it because it's so infrequent. It's so few and far between. Maybe Lions fans, long-suffering as they are, kind of, you know, or not Lions fans, but the people of Detroit or people who in Northwest Ohio might have leaned toward Detroit kind of feel the same way.
Possibly? And I'm going to jump in if I can with both of you guys on that. I think that's part of the Lions explanation, at least here in this town. They're bottoming out. Yeah, there was Barry Sanders, of course, through the 90s, but outside of that, they had more downtimes earlier, so that shift already happened. That's at least how I view it from an almost third-person point of view.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I'll give you the last word on this, Carl, because we've got some other things to do, buddy. What do you think about that? So you don't think there's any stigma, and it's not, you know, considered to be, what's the word, taboo, if you will, to live as close to Detroit or Cleveland as you do and root for the Steelers?
There is a little bit, but it's not like I'm a New York or L.A. fan. I mean, who wants to be a New York or an L.A. fan, you know? That's a totally different stigma than Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's only 4 hours away. It's no big deal. I go to 3 games a year, you know? So it's not like there is. I mean, come on. I mean, most people don't like Steelers fans, you know? I mean, most of them are cocky.
You're probably considered a bandwagon fan. I know my son, who, like I said, is 14 now. He's considered a bandwagon fan because he has abandoned the Browns. He has had no reason to cheer for them in his young 14 years of life. So you probably are. There is going to be a bit of a stigma there, but probably not as much today as there would have been 20 years ago.
Right. I agree. And I'll tell you what, one last thing. You know, you can't they say bandwagon fan, but I'll tell you, when you remember names like that from your childhood, like Chris Fahamutu Malafalu, I mean, it's you know, that's hard to be a bandwagon fan there.
Well done. Yeah, I think you got it right. Christian, wasn't it? Christian Fuamatu Maafala.
Yeah. Well done. Yeah, number 45, yep.
You got it. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Let me squeeze Mark in Toledo under the air real quick before we get to Coach Jenks. Hey, Mark, go ahead. What do you think about all that?
Well, I have to tell you, I think today with the younger kids, it's all definitely media-driven on who they choose. But I'm 62 years old. I've been a Steelers fan since 69. And prior to that, I was a Lions fan, but it was Joe Green coming out of college, and I read an article about him in Sports Illustrated, you know, because that was our Bible back then. That's how you got sports.
That's right.
And just started following him and, you know, went through a 1-13 season and had a jersey and had all of that kind of stuff. But the rest of it, you know, I was born a Tiger fan. My father was a Tiger fan from the 1930s. You know, and I'm one of the kind of guys, the rest of Detroit teams too. I'm definitely a Pistons and a Red Wings fan. But I when I was growing up, we all had American League and National League teams. So I kind of jumped onto the Pirates bandwagon back in the days of Clemente and everything. So it was kind of nice because we could always root for one or the other, and unless they played in the World Series, you never had to choose.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's how I was with the Indians and the Reds in the 1970s. Growing up as a kid, I had two favorite teams, Reds and Indians. I don't know if it was simply because they were both Ohio, because I was just a big fan of the big red machine, and then the Indians because I grew up in Cleveland, but there was never a danger of them meeting because the Indians were never going to make it to the World Series back then. Now, of course, it is a different story with interleague play and competitiveness changing.
One thing that in this area, you know, with the Steelers, when the Browns jumped ship and became the Ravens, and you had that period where there was an empty thing. 1470, which was the predecessor to 106.5 for sports in town, they actually broadcast Steeler games in Toledo,
And I mean,
there's a good reason for that, because while the Cowboys enjoy the mantra, you know, the title of America's team, the Steelers are one of the most popular teams. They're one of the most hated. They're a little bit like the Raiders in that regard. They probably have more people hating them out of jealousy of their six or seven rings or whatever it is. But there are, you know, just as many people who like them, who wave terrible towels in cities all across the country, let alone one that's not too terribly distant from them, like Toledo. So that doesn't surprise me at all that their games were carried there. Anybody looking to make money on the National Football League, you don't have to go much farther than the Steelers, because their popularity is going to remain very, very
high. I can attest to that last part, guys. Mm-hmm. You know, a little insider information. This may have been a year ago with the proverbial higher-ups here, and we were serious, but there was a smirk on all of our face at the same time that if we ever lost the Lions, we would actually be trying for the Steelers before the Browns, just because it would sell better. That actually happened.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And look at the last two callers, and thank you, Mark. I got to run, buddy. The last two callers that we took both didn't say, oh, well, I'm a Brown. They're in Northwest Ohio, Toledo residents, born and raised, and they just, you heard them.
Yep.
They're Steelers fans, so it wouldn't surprise me at all, Jim. It would be better for business. All right, here's something I want to do just for you. Hold on a second. I'm not doing it right. I got to make sure that you can hear this thing. I love the open to this, so it's going to make it worthwhile when I play it again. Here we go.
Carry on, my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done.
Finish it.
Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
That's my way of telling you I've got Kansas tickets. November 4th at Stranahan. And I want to give a pair of them to you right now. Caller 7, lucky number 7. You're going to get a pair of tickets to go see Kansas at Stranahan November 4th. Then we're going to get a local sports center here at the bottom of the hour. Then we're going to hear from head coach Mike Jenks, head coach of Bowling Green State University, about their loss to Northern Illinois on Saturday and their upcoming game with Kent State. He'll chat with Jim Cushman coming up. 866-240-1065, the number, caller 7. Those tickets are yours. Back after this.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here. Time to turn our attention to some college football. It was not a pleasant day for the Bowling Green Falcons back on Saturday. Their final Saturday game by the bye, as they fell 48-17 to Northern Illinois at the Doit. Now the action games begin. The Falcons not in action again until coming up on a Halloween night, by the bye, at Kent State. And to help us talk all things Bowling Green football-wise, we once again welcome in the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jenks, joining us here on the program. Hi, Coach. How you doing?
Doing well, Jim. How are you?
Not too bad. 48-17, the final back on Saturday against Northern Illinois. Was this just one of those games where they just ran out quick and that was kind of the end of it?
It was as bad as it sounds. Absolutely. Kind of for the first time all year that really felt like, from a physical standpoint, we got it handed to us. And credit goes to them. You know, they came out and, you know, they were a highly touted defensive unit, and rightfully so. They were physical. They forced some turnovers, and they took advantage of it. And then from an offensive standpoint, early on in the ball game, they really executed at a high level, and they got up to a quick 14-0 start. We battled back 14-7 and really, really couldn't get anything going pretty much all day long. They beat us soundly.
And obviously, you know, Northern Illinois has had a recent history, as we know, that they've been at the top of this conference for a little while, or relative to those couple of down years the last couple. But was this game just a matter of a talent differentiation, or were they just better on this individual day?
We could have done some things to make it a better football game, but they're a good football team this year. They beat Nebraska for a reason. And you don't just go up to Lincoln and get that done. They're playing at a high level right now. They're playing at a confident level. And again, they're offensively, they're just not going to beat themselves. They're going to control the ball. They're going to run the football. They're going to take time off the clock. And then they realize that, you know, they've got a top five ranked defense, not just in the MAC, but in the country. So, felt like we were able to move the ball, against them early in the ball game. Really, the most rushing yards they've given up so far this season is 128. We had 100 in the first half, ended up with 192. So there were some positive things there. I just kind of got overwhelmed and overmatched a little bit. Had some injuries that kind of hurt us a little bit. Timmy going out, our four-year starter at center, and then the guy right next to him, Jack Kramer, both of those guys went out in the first quarter. And then once that happened, they were just a little bit too physical for us to handle on this particular day.
What do you tell your guys in the locker room after a game like this to keep their confidence up?
Well, you tell them to give Northern Illinois all the credit and that, you know, you hope that it hurts and it stings because it should. And it shows you where we've got to go and you know, what we've got to do to in order to be on the field and you know, give ourselves to get a victory against a team that is playing at a really high level.
Now, talk to me about some of those injuries. By the way, we're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. 48-17, Falcons fell at the Deut back on Saturday against Northern Illinois. Talk to me about some of those injuries you mentioned a few months ago. I mean, it's detrimental to any football team where if you lose a center and one of your guards right next to him, what are the status of those guys?
Well, not looking good so far. I tell you what, this bye week or these 10 days came in a perfect time. You know, Caleb Bright's going to have to step up probably at the center position, and we'll probably go guard by committee, rotating a few redshirt freshmen in there, and they'll get baptism by fire. No better time than action on national television. But they'll go out and they'll compete, and our coaches are getting ready to go.
Let's talk about at least one of the positives that you mentioned. The running game ran up 192, which is a season high, as you mentioned, against Northern Illinois. Claire with 108. Talk to me about that. It was, as you mentioned, especially early, one of the things that was going your way.
Yeah, we really moved the ball for the first three, four possessions. You know, and we knew we wanted to commit to the run because, if they put you in a passing situation, they've got 21, 22 sacks. One of the tops in the country. Then Smith, number 15, you know, he had 9.5, and he was leading the MAC in sacks. So we knew we didn't want to be in that situation, so we felt like we had to stick to the run, and we were having some success at it, you know. And when those guys go out, you know, we weren't able to have the same kind of success, and we're forced to throw it a little bit. And you know, we made some key mistakes. I think we threw three picks, and that's not going to get it done against a good football team.
Yeah, and let's go to those quarterbacks. Morgan, 7-12, 71 yards, did have a touchdown, but two of the interceptions. And then Grant Loy, the freshman coming in, 6-11, he was 104, had the third interception. Was this a scoreboard kind of thing? Wanted to get Loy some work, or was something else going on here with the change?
I think in the second quarter, I think we threw two back-to-back picks at a point that we were in the game. And just felt like at that moment we needed some sort of a spark, so we inserted Grant Loy, and you know, he threw a tip. He also threw an interception, but his was on a tip ball. He showed that what we thought, that there's some athleticism there. He ran around, made some plays with his feet, but still got a long way to go.
We're talking with head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks, here on the Extravaganza. Falcons fell this past Saturday, 48-17, to Northern Illinois, dropping their record to a 1-7 on the year. What do you say to some fans or students, for example, that might be getting a little antsy, thinking, "Oh goodness, 1-7? Oh man, what's going to happen?" What do you tell them?
I tell them that you've been here before. We've been here before as a program, and the key to turning this thing back around and getting to the back on top is going to be consistency and staying together as a football family. You know, because if not, and you tear this thing up from within, it'll take another 10 years, like from 92 to 2002 and 02 to 2012. My job is to keep recruiting at a high level, keep taking the core unit that we have and getting them to understand how to win football games. You're looking at a ball club that very easily, we got beat, I'm telling you, handily, Saturday afternoon. But we could still be sitting here 3-1 in MAC play. You know, we had to lead in into the third, fourth quarter in both those ball games, playing a youthful group. So it's not as far away as one might think. We're going to keep working. I know our kids are staying together, and we'll get this thing going in the right direction sooner or later.
You guys now shift. The Saturday games are done. Three Tuesday and a Wednesday game coming up. You guys not in action until a little over a week from now against Kent State on the road on Halloween night. So shifting into a Maction play now. First of all, in this first week leading up to it, since you guys don't play this weekend, how does that change your various practice schedules and things leading up? Are the kids going to get a day off or two?
They do. They're going to get today off, and we'll bring them back up, and we'll try to, you know, they'll spend some extra time with Coach Jay, our strength and conditioning coach, just on with their cardio and stretching and things of that nature. Really, we're beaten, we're banged up. It was a tough haul for us over the past 8 weeks. And it kind of came to a culmination Saturday afternoon. So we got to get healthy. And then at the same time, we got to get some younger guys coached up and ready to play by next Tuesday. We've got a couple coaches that will be on the road for the next 2 days, and then we'll get back in here on Wednesday, finalize a game plan, and we'll treat this Thursday as a normal game week Monday. So it's kind of lick your wounds, get healthy, get some guys in with some extra film study, and getting ready to play.
Now, we're rearranging some of the schedules of when I get to talk to you, Coach, so I won't talk to you again until after that game on Halloween night at Kent State. And the Golden Flashes, 1-3, 2-6 in terms of MAC play and overall. So since we won't talk to you until after that game, what can you tell us about the Golden Flashes?
Well, they're playing better football. Right now, Coach Haynes has got them playing great defense, and, he's well known for that. They've struggled a little bit offensively. Kind of rotating quarterbacks, looking for that guy to light a spark for them as well. They're athletic in the backfield, athletic at the receiving position. And we're going to have to play a sound game, not turn it over. They went down and were able to get a good victory versus Miami as well. And so they'll be ready to play. It's at their place. We kind of played them at the same time of the year last year during action play, I should say. And kind of jumped on them a little bit. I'm sure they'll remember that, and they'll be hungry to get after our tail a little bit.
It's the Bowling Green Bowling Green on the road, I should say, next Tuesday, Halloween night at Kent State. That's the next time they're in action as they shift to the Maction part of the schedule. A couple of Tuesdays and a Wednesday game sprinkled out for the remainder of the season. Coach, best of luck out there on Tuesday night. We'll be hoping for the best. And when we reconvene later on next week, post of that game, we're hoping we're talking about a Falcons win to get the second win overall and in MAC play. Best of luck out there, Coach.
Appreciate you, man. Treats, all treats, no tricks, brother.
Well said, well said. Head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks, taking a few minutes talking with us. And yeah, you heard it there in the way he was kind of talking. We've had past conversations where, a thing or two here goes a little different. We might be able to win that game. And they have played better, have the Bowling Green Falcons, since MAC play started. But there's just not much you can do against a team like Northern Illinois. Yeah, they're not as strong as they were just a couple of years ago, but that's still a team with the win, 5-2 overall, and then you get injuries, at the front and center of your offensive line, which doesn't help things. And you heard Coach there; they just simply played better. There wasn't one or two different things that the Falcons could have done differently to have changed the outcome of that game relative to, say, some of the other games so far in MAC play. It was just one of those things. And I love his answer when I asked about the fans and the students who might be getting antsy seeing 1-7. And his response is, no, you can't tear this thing back down. Then you'll end up with a 10-year, I'm kind of paraphrasing, 10-year dark age the way it was for the 90s and parts of the 2000s. And he's got a good point there. And this is something that I've been advocating as well. I would not pull the plug on this current coaching staff or anything like that. And I know I've been hearing those grumblings, and you know who you are, by the by, but it just is what it is right now, that the talent is in flux and things in this program need to be rebuilt. And, I'm a firm believer, and maybe this is my NFL Browns fandom coming out, but you can't just be pulling the plug, mid-stroke in a rebuild, because that just sets you back even farther. And that's what Coach is trying to convey to all those who may be antsy and getting a little frustrated by the fact that this team is 1-7 right now. They were basically this type of record. They were 1-8, if you recall, one season ago, won their final three to make it 4-8. So as we know, it's not been a good last 2 years, the two seasons of Coach Jinks at the helm, but the talent disparity is what's going on right now. And so the recruiting and getting these young guys to play better, to learn about the game more, and to help that translate as you go forward on the scoreboard, it's rough, and no one's discounting how rough this is right now for the Bowling Green Falcons, but I'm glad that he answered it the way he did, because I'm with him. You don't want to pull the plug on this. And I know to a certain degree he's saying that to protect his own job, of course, as any sane person would. But I agree with him when if the athletic director and whatnot decide that they want to pull the plug on Coach Jinks after this season, for example, I just think that would be the wrong move to make. There are some things, obviously, right now that are just leaving bad taste in people's mouths, and that's totally understandable. More is expected from this program, which, as we know, has been one of the stronger programs throughout the entire history of this conference. But all strong programs, especially at this level, also have lean years on top of them. I mean, the University of Toledo, the Rockets had those lean years in the mid-2000s. I mean, really the only bright spot of those couple lean years was when they went up to Ann Arbor under Rich Rod and beat them. But otherwise, it had a very similar feel then for the Rockets as it does now for the Falcons. And you can't be changing program philosophies midway through. Let's call it what it is. It's been more or less a rebuild since the beginning of last season. And rebuilds at this level of college football take a little bit of time because you got to get that talent, you got to get those recruits, and then they got to play and perform and learn things in order to get better. And it's rough right now. There's no question about it. But I hope that this team does not decide to change things mid-stroke with a new philosophy and a new guy and everything, because that will set them back another year or so on this planet. Now, will this, at the end of the day, under Coach Jinks, get them to an East Division title and a MAC title game appearances like we had just a few short seasons ago? We don't know. I mean, that remains to be seen. But I do agree with him. You change those kind of things now, and you might be setting your program back another year, because a new coach and a new staff brings with it a new recruiting philosophy. And say what you will about what we see out there right now, the important part is to keep getting these young guys experience, keep bringing in the talent via recruiting, and hope that things improve as we go from this year into next year. Again, I know it's rough right now, but I've been strongly and will continue to strongly advocate against making that big kind of change. And that's going to do it for this Tuesday edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Drive Time, Mike Miller coming at you next. And then a little bit later tonight, got some fun stuff for you later tonight. 7 to 8, Bill Clark and the crew, the High School Football Forum, last regular season edition, because it all comes to a head with Week 10 this Friday night. So they're going to get a look at a lot of the playoff teams and where some things are going to go coming up on Friday and how those will affect some playoffs. And then as soon as that's done at 8 o'clock, we're going to send you to L.A., ESPN Radio. We're, of course, the ESPN Radio affiliate here in town. And coming up at 8, Game 1 of the 2017 World Series. You got the Astros and the Dodgers from Dodger Stadium. It should be a very interesting series. And by the way, you guys know I'm an Indians fan, but given my team's streak down the stretch at the end, we're actually where we thought we would be end of May. These are the two best teams in baseball in 2017. Pains me to have to say that as an Indians fan, but these are the two best teams, Astros and Dodgers, in Major League Baseball in 2017, and there they are facing off in the World Series. If you're a fan, you can't ask for much more. That's at 8 o'clock coverage time right here, Game 1 of the World Series here on the ticket. That'll be following the High School Football Forum, but stay tuned. Mike Miller, Drive Time, coming at you next. We'll talk all about these things and more tomorrow. We'll reconvene on a Wednesday. See ya.